What is design, and what role should design play in the world to come? To explore these questions, we welcome the legendary design thought leader, Richard Buchanan, to the show. Richard is professor of information systems in the Department of Design and Innovation at the Waterhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University, and also chaired professor of design theory and practice at the College of Design and Innovation at Tongji University in Shanghai. He is a widely published author of books and articles, including Discovering Design, and he is an editor of the MIT journal Design Issues. My name is Dirk Niemeyer, a social futurist interested in systems that will make the quality of our lives better. My partner is Jonathan Follett, a writer, composer, and emerging tech researcher. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 1 of Creative Next, a show about future-proofing creatives in a world of AI automation. Let's get started. Season 3 of Creative Next is about form, how we create the things that make up our world. While we are going to explore pursuits like art and music, our primary focus this season is on design. Design is an odd profession. Most other trades have clear delineation between professionals and amateurs. Take, for example, engineering. Now, in design, it is common for anyone who comes into contact with a design to criticize and propose improvements to it. The old joke in graphic design is to say the logo ended up pink because the CEO spouse's favorite color is pink. There is a perception that the output is merely a product of opinion, that the difference between the final pink logo and the designed orange one is not meaningful. On the other hand, engineers rarely face similar external controls. The number of people who would even consider offering improvements to draft works are small and generally well-educated. They are offering suggestions more often based on their own expert knowledge and analytical considerations, as opposed to opinion or personal preference. In design, the average person often perceives their opinion to be as informed as the designer's. This is the result of numerous issues, including the fact that the designers themselves often cannot articulate the reasons why for their decisions. Design is often the result of instinct, the subconscious synthesis of factors that result in a particular solution. Unlike the engineer, who has clear rationale related to math and science for their decisions, the designer often can't bring their choices into an analytical frame. Combined with the fact that they are choices that in the most literal sense anyone can make, designer or spouse each could pick a color for a logo to extend that example. And design becomes a servant of power as opposed to an initiate for superior solutions. Now, to be clear, this is not necessarily a bad thing. After all, design is intertwined with culture. The best designs are solving specific problems for specific contexts within the broader context of the culture those solutions will live within. There are, in fact, moments when the CEO's spouse will have a better feel for the exact specific problem space than the designer. This is one of the reasons why the model of professional design evolved from the expert auteur model into the collaborative team model, and most recently, the designer as facilitator model. To be clear, all of these and other variations of design practice are still in use. But increasingly, the vanguard of design has shifted to a model where the problem solving is distributed across both time and people. This is an important dynamic to think about as we look at design from a number of different perspectives. Speaking of different perspectives, we are honored to welcome Richard Buchanan to the show. Dr. Buchanan, who kindly allowed me to refer to him by his casual name, Dick, during our interview, has been a pace setter in theories of and definitions for design for decades. He enunciated the term design thinking more than a decade before consulting companies got their hooks into it as a marketing differentiator. He is a big thinker about design, and we'll start our season off by considering it from a more holistic perspective.
I think when we talk about design today, we're talking about something a little bit different, though. Something happened around 1900 that changed the way culture deals with the world. And it's a significant matter. And it's interesting that design, as we understand it, arose precisely at the time that we were tossing out the principles and ideas of the 19th century. We turned away from, metaphysics and a lot of other complicated stuff. We looked at human experience. and experimentation. And design came into being exactly at that time of experimentation. It's a very powerful moment, and I think many of the traces of design from the very early times, the Werkbund and work with the Morris Group and so forth, all of that is refocusing on what it is to experience in the world and how we experiment with materials and forms and just ways of being together. We've learned how to make things more effectively. It's taken a long time to do that. And I think a lot of designers today and business people don't understand how profound the change was in our culture beginning around 1900. We moved to creating everything around us in our environment, including organizations and businesses. Organizations are the biggest design products of the 20th century. We have to recognize that. I teach in the School of Management, and we know that there are 12 or 15 major theories of organizations. They're all 20th century matters of how we design better organizations. So whether it's business or in the areas of design that we know about, in communication and artifacts or services, wherever it is, design is a special developed capability out of human beings.
The premise of design experiencing a metamorphosis around the turn of the 20th century, beyond merely the rise of digital design, is a fascinating and new idea for me. Beyond the design of organizations, I wanted to know more about what this was and how it came to be. Let's listen.
We had exhausted the possibilities of the way people were thinking in the 18th and 19th century. We had exhausted the capabilities. And it began to lose touch with where we are as people trying to find our way in the world. And the question is, well, where do we turn? What do we look to? If we can't look to the way the mind works, and that's what they did in the 19th century, they looked to will and reason and imagination. But if we can't look there, where can we find a firm grounding for how we live our lives? And I think there was a fundamental understanding that emerged all across the range of cultural activities, that we turn to what we say and what we do as the best place to begin to understand the world. Once you change the premise, once you begin to look at experience and expression, what happens to design? Well, design begins by developing a lot of communication capabilities. So graphic design or print, whether it's images or words, lots of work in graphic design unfolded. It exploded. Posters and books and magazines and newspapers. That's one big area of design that emerged. And it impacted business as well as the daily life of people. At the same time, there was a development of the capacity of artifacts. The artifacts that we live with every day, whether it's chairs and dinnerware or any other physical object. At the same time that we were looking at communication and mass communication, we're looking at mass production of artifacts. So that's the beginning of design in the early part of the 20th century. Curiously enough, when you go through these, and I call these the four orders of design. The first order is communication. The second order is things and artifacts. The third order of design began to emerge in the 60s when we began to say, not just how do we make the products, the artifacts, but how do we interact with those artifacts? How do we deal with control surfaces, with machine control? And so the idea of interacting with the artifacts around us began to emerge as the next development of design. And out of that came a huge, huge swath of new design practices, whether it's service design or design and policy or all kinds of experiences being created and shaped. And then we began to say, well, if we are designing interactions, then what's the context of those interactions? Are there platforms, for instance? How do we create the bigger environments, the organizations, the systems within which those interactions take place? So all four orders of design, beginning with communication, then to artifacts, then to designing actions and interactions, and finally designing the bigger environments and systems. That's the progression of design. And we live in that today now at the beginning of the 21st century with a great force of all four of these orders working together.
Communication, things, interactions, and experiences. That framework resonates with the things I've learned in my career in design as well. And I remember around the turn of the 20th century being part of the vanguard of designers normalizing experience as our focus. The model makes sense. Still, I am also aware of examples of these ideas in practice in far earlier times. For example, the life and career of Henry Ford and the Ford Motor Company during his life is a case study in innovation and experiential thinking. I mentioned this counterfactual to Dick, and he embraced it with zeal.
Ford, generally, is a great example of just what I'm getting at here. It illustrates the move through the second, third, and fourth orders of design. Ford is an interesting character. I have curious regard for him. There's a great documentary on him in the American Experience series, and I recommend this to everyone. It's just a great portrayal of the life of Henry Ford and what he did. It's all a design story, beginning with his invention of the possibility of bringing the city to the farm. And believe me, that's where Ford began. How do you bring the city to the farm, or the farm to the city, either way? And then from that, understanding the discovery of the physical artifacts, he became a mechanic and made machines and little things that ran, motors and so forth. And then watching, here's a major moment then for Ford that we should think about. He and some of his colleagues went to Chicago, and they went to, and get this, they went to a meatpacking plant, and they watched hog carcasses coming down on hooks. And as they went by, butchers would carve off the big chunks of meat to be packaged and sent out to the stores for sale. A light bulb went off. And they went back to Detroit, and guess what? They said, maybe there's a thing called an assembly line. They began to build the first motors through an assembly line process. This was the third great step. This is the interaction that's coming forward, a great new interactive process and form. And that worked wonderfully well, and it gradually expanded, and you know the story is complex. But Ford had an intuition that went beyond artifacts and interactions. He had an idea that was so unusual. He said, suppose we doubled the wages of all of our workers. And people thought that he had lost his mind. I would say that they thought he was going to bring everything to destruction. But Ford had an intuition about the bigger systems within which he was working, within which we're living. And he realized that if he could double the salary of his workers, they would have the capacity to buy automobiles, they would buy other things in the economy. The whole economic system would develop and emerge from that. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. It was an amazing development. The people who thought it couldn't be done, well, it was done. So Ford accomplishes all four of the orders of design, moving from the earliest communications and ideas to the artifacts, to the interactions and the assembly line, to finally the big systems. And here is the point that maybe we should think carefully about today. Ford did very well in creating River Rouge and the big systems, but at some point, when the big systems we create begin to oppress us, begin to dictate to us how we live our lives, when they begin to shape us in ways that we don't really want, that's when trouble occurs. Fourth order design is around us in huge profusion today in the 21st century, but we're reaching the boundary zones of what fourth order design can do. The big systems and platforms that we're creating are beginning to become oppressive. We think maybe they've lost touch with the principles that guided their initial creation. And finding those principles is part of the task of design today, to look back and say, what are the principles that lead us to create the things around us? And maybe those big systems lose touch with the principles that make them valuable and worthwhile.
Thanks in large part to Steve Jobs and his company Apple Inc., design in the 2000s was increasingly interwoven with innovation in the public consciousness. Looking to the past, Henry Ford's doubling the wages of workers is the best possible example of the power of true and paradigm-shifting innovation. It meaningfully changed the world and future while helping Detroit to become an important global city. However, 50 years later, Detroit was in a steep decline, on the path to being the United States poster child for urban flight, industrial decline, and poor civic planning. It's a reminder that everything is part of a larger system, and that things change with time. While around 1900 was the perfect moment for Henry Ford in Detroit, the world continued to move and change. The advances and lessons from that time and effort spread around the world, being expanded and improved upon as globalization brought us all closer in time, distance, and relative economic parity. In the process, Ford waned and Detroit wilted. It's a reminder that the real solutions, the ones that are most sustainable, are systemic in nature and highly complex. and that even the best of today can later spawn the worst of tomorrow. What are some recent examples of professional designers having a broader impact in their practice?
I know that back at in the late 1990s, I led a team down to Australia and this is going to sound strange, but this is the case. We went down to redesign the Australian taxation system. And when I would come back to the States and say, well, we were designing the taxation system, colleagues and friends would say, oh, you're working on the tax forms. And I said, no, we're redesigning the tax system. And I could count like 5 seconds, 1001, 1002. And by the time I got to 5 seconds, eyes lit up and said, oh my God, you've gotten the keys to the kingdom. Yes, indeed, we had been given the keys to the kingdom. Design suddenly moved up from being a handmaid to other interests to becoming an influence at a very high level. And I think that was a very powerful moment. That's one of the first projects that begin what I call fourth order design. It's not the only one. There are a couple of others that occurred in the 1990s. But today, fourth order design is occurring in social innovations in different parts of the world. It's happening in Africa. It's certainly here in Asia. We know it's in the States. We know it's in Europe. It's the cases where designers are coming in to look at ways to improve the quality of life in the environments and the systems that surround us. So in Africa, we find communities that come together. And what's curious about this is that no longer is the designer the driving central force. Designers have become facilitators because the action is occurring by the community itself in many cases. Now, this is not entirely the case. There are some places where designers play a very important role. I think in high-level management and business issues, there are a few designers that I know who are very powerful and effective in thinking about the way large business enterprises work. But it's occurred not just in these large businesses, but in social processes, activities, in government. There's a huge movement around the world to bring design into governmental activities. It's happening certainly in Scandinavian countries. There was a big move in Finland for a while. It's moved into Denmark. I have colleagues there. It's moved into the UK. It's moved into Germany. One of my former doctoral students is involved in designing policy with the German government. And she works at an international level as well. It's amazing the work she's doing. These are all examples of fourth order design. This exciting possibility that we can rebuild the world around us if we're very thoughtful and if we do one thing in particular. We must pay attention to the principles. What principles organize the world around us?
Thinking about these examples of fourth order design, this is the sort of design work that will be least impacted by automation in the near term. The combination of the newness of the work, the breadth of complex content that must be understood, the size of the systems, all of these things conspire to make a problem space that will be, for the foreseeable future, human. Of course, these constitute just a small number of the totality of design activities happening in the world, most of which are far more mundane and relating to lower-order creations, such as communications and artifacts. We will be exploring those in more specific depth during the season. But for now, let's continue to enjoy this rarefied air and pivot to the topic of creativity.
But creativity is this art that I'm talking about. And I believe we can teach that to most people. I'm different than a lot of my colleagues who think only special people can be creative. No, I think virtually everyone can be creative, but we need to understand what we mean by creativity in design or elsewhere. And let me give you an example. We tend to have a fairly narrow notion of what creativity is today. If you look around us, we say, well, it's innovation. But actually there are four big terms that are at the core of what we think of as creativity or should be thinking of as creativity. The first is invention. Invention is when you come up with a new idea. And there's a way of doing that, a systematic way of challenging yourself and asking good questions and thoughtful questions. But once you have an invention, a new idea, you then take it out into the world of experience. And you begin to experiment with the things around us. And that leads to discovery. We discover things about the world around us through that invention. Now, here's the kicker. You remember earlier I mentioned Henry Ford? The movement of Ford was from invention to discovery. And then when they went to Chicago, they saw this meatpacking plant. And it's a story that has no connection to making automobiles, absolutely no connection to making automobiles. And yet their mind sparked with the crossover of the theme of things moving along and being acted on. Suddenly that was the source of innovation. Innovation is when we make a connection between two different stories that don't seem to fit together, but the human imagination sparks and sees the connection. Finding that connection is what innovation is about. And that's what we mean by creativity typically today. So we talk about it as innovation. But the truth is that that's just one of the terms. But there is one more term. So we have invention, we have discovery, we have innovation, which is the connections across stories and we see new ideas. But the fourth term is something that the cognitive psychologists just pull their hair out when it comes up. It's intuition. I've got to tell you, intuition has played a central role in human culture from an early time. Some of the most important work is The Nature of Intuition, which I think is vastly misunderstood today. I don't believe that the cognitive psychologists have fully grasped what intuition is. But intuition is the fourth form of creativity. I can give you a good example. When they were creating the London Underground, and you know that's a wonderful, huge complex, they hired a man to do a map of the underground. Now they had maps before, and they were, well, I have a series of these I like to show people. They're hard to understand. But this man, Mr. Beck, he drew the most curious map that you could imagine. And when the company saw it, they thought he had lost his mind. They were going to fire him. But they said, well, okay, we'll do a few hundred of these and put them out in the stations, and then we'll move on and find a better map. Those maps were picked up within a couple of days. They were all gone. And the question is, why? What was there in those maps that made them so incredibly popular? And here's the idea. I think Mr. Beck grasped the core idea of what is a system. And the company owners didn't understand it, but the ordinary people grasped had the intuition to realize they were looking at a system. And they realized they could get in anywhere. And if they followed the pathways, they could get where they needed to go. That intuition of some small connection that you can build a system around, that's the kind of creativity I'm talking about. And it's a very special moment, and designers know about this really well. So we have these four terms for creativity: invention, discovery, innovation, and intuition.
I so appreciate how Dick has broken down these abstract concepts into clear and logical systems. Creativity is invention, discovery, innovation, and intuition. I want to reflect on this some more to decide if it seems comprehensive, but I'm digging it so far. How do these concepts translate into design?
But you can't teach that in the craft of design. This belongs to the art of design. And the art of design then is this ability to, yes, use this the craft steps, that's fine. But what goes on in our mind that lets us see possibilities, that's something that can't be replicated in the computer. That can't be done there. It's done inside our own mind. That's what design thinking is about. It's how we think about situations and realize possibilities. And I think, to be honest, I think we've not paid nearly enough attention to these four terms and how to make them more teachable, I suppose you'd say, how we can share an understanding of this. It opens a different pathway for us. I think it's important in business. I think this is a special domain in business, but I think it applies everywhere.
Indeed, these would be worthy concepts to teach more explicitly from the time children are in school. If we were forced to choose, which is more important for the average person to learn, geometry or creativity? To me, the answer seems self-evident, and it's not what's being taught in most schools today. Getting back to design as craft, what are its key tools?
Well, I do think that there is an evolution in the tools. There is a core understanding, the base. I think that two things count heavily for us in design. One is drawing. And by drawing, I don't mean just simply sketching and representational. I mean our ability to put on a piece of paper relationships of ideas, sometimes with recognizable figures and representations, but often just simply the diagramming. This is a kind of drawing. The drawing lets us take what's in our imagination and bring it out into the world to share with colleagues as we are developing. So whatever tool helps us to bring our visualizations forward, those are the tools of design. So I think drawing is certainly a part of it, and all kinds of drawing. I know at Carnegie Mellon, we had a superb program in drawing with four different dimensions of drawing, different ways of thinking about drawing. But I think that all of the tools that support that are key, whether it's a pencil or the computer. And I've seen wonderful work with computers. Some people have great skill in using the computer to draw. but I don't think it's only representational. So the whiteboard is a wonderful invention. I think it's a cool one. But I think the second I wanted to get at is prototyping, the ability to make construct tentative objects, tentative representations, the physical objects, the prototypes of what will eventually be made. I think this ability, the first, the ability to draw, and second, the ability to fashion prototypes. And I can prototype a service, I can prototype a system, I can prototype an artifact, I can prototype even a poster for a festival. Those are just the early sketches. It's the bringing it out into the world and seeing how the parts fit together and seeing how we can break it apart into different parts that people can take on in their own ways.
Reflecting on these comments, they all come back to taking what is in your mind and turning it into a concrete form that is helping to share that idea with others, or turn the idea into reality. Many of the foundational tools and technology of human history have served to assist our doing this, particularly on the communication side, from pigments to writing to the printing press to the pencil to software. Augmenting our ability to translate what is in our mind to the real world is core to the history of technology. But it raises the question, what role could artificial intelligence play? How might AI improve our ability to bring our minds to life? Going back to the things we learned on the last season of the show, AI struggles with context. The human mind is perhaps the most complex, defined, closed system of context there is. Despite advances in direct mind-to-human interfaces, we have not realized nor are on the precipice of machine learning technology being able to learn and encapsulate our minds. So while smartware tools will increasingly augment these aspects of design, it is an area where artificial intelligence will be less directly present in the near future. We will learn more about all of this, as well as areas where AI impacts design, art, and music, as this season goes on. For now, let's pivot to hear about how Dick thinks about technology, including artificial intelligence.
But here's a point I want to make with you, and I think people should have forgotten this. Maybe we should keep it in mind. We have a misunderstanding of what technology is. We think technology is hardware and software. And I'm sorry, that's not what technology fundamentally is. That's a part of it, I'll grant you that. But if you take the word technology, techne means art, and the ology side means science. Technology is the art of science or the science of art. And you know, if you think about design thinking, we use technologies, but they're technologies of the mind. Our arts of rhetoric and logic and so forth, the things that we use in design thinking to plan the world around us. Well, the computer functions in ways to imitate, to try to simulate some of those human capacities, those technologies of the mind, and they want to put them into the mechanical brain, and some of that works, and a lot of it doesn't. But I think it's important we keep these two meanings of technology very clear in our minds, and I'll tell you why we have to do this. We are coming to a point where the concern for artificial intelligence is beginning to drown out the human side of the way we live our lives. I'm very interested in AI. When I was at Carnegie Mellon, I used to have arguments and discussions with Herb Simon. And Herb and I agreed about very little, it seems. But we both shared the University of Chicago. And in a curious way, we had a respect for each other. I enjoyed working with him. He's a smart man. And he was good, but we disagreed. But he was a proponent of AI. And he said, AI is around us everywhere. And I admit it is. My interest was not in AI. My interest was in IA, intelligence amplification or intelligence augmentation. He wanted artificial intelligence. I wanted to know how is human intelligence augmented by these technologies. And I think we're moving today, at the beginning of the 21st century, we're just beginning to get the question, is there something called IA that will be the way that we deal with AI? We have to explore this in design and other places more carefully. What is it we do as humans that's so special that we can use AI to support, but that can't be duplicated by machines? That's what interests me in the technology. So this is a big, complicated story, I know, but this is how technology takes on this richer meaning and how the tools that we use are so interesting and intriguing and not what we expect. Now, I know young people coming into the field, they're very big on tools and the technologies, and you know, we spend a lot of time teaching this at Carnegie Mellon, but we spend a lot of time teaching students also how to think about problems. And the ability to think about problems is what differentiates people in the workplace. If you can think about a problem, you will find a job. There will be a place for you, always. That's a big deal for me.
The notion of IA, or intelligence augmentation, is a useful one. It not only moves the focus from the technology to the humanity, it correctly frames the core issue. How do we best augment the things we are doing? As we've talked about repeatedly since the first episode of our show, AI is not some truly artificial intelligence or new form of life. It's just technology that is really good at some narrow and specific things. Those things are interesting and powerful, but that is only because of the ways they can help us, ostensibly by augmenting our own capabilities and intelligence. Let's wrap up with Dick's thoughts about the relationship between design, intent, and awareness.
One of the biggest concerns I have, and let me tell you a story. I was invited to a crit at a business school. You know, business schools are teaching design thinking these days. And I went to the crit. It was a project for a hospital system. And the students were creating a subsystem within that hospital. And when they presented their work, I looked at this and some things didn't quite feel right. So I asked the students, I said, what's the basis for your decision? What principle guided you in making this decision? Well, the students scratched their head and looked at each other. They were very puzzled. They didn't know what to do. Finally, somebody said, it just looked like a good idea. And I thought, oh my God, what has gone wrong in the field of design? You know, I could think of 12 or 15 reasons for the decision, but none of them were just, it looks like a good idea. What I'm concerned about is that we've lost touch with the principles of design, why we design. And if these students had thought carefully about why they were designing, I think they would have realized that the features they were promoting were terrible. They should not have been there, both the language of expression and the features themselves. So here's my point. I think that we have lost touch with the principles of design. And I don't mean there's a single principle. There are many, many principles. It's a world of pluralism. But if we don't think about the deeper reasons for what we do and bring that into our practice in a practical way to make choices about materials, about the ways we produce, about the goals, about the choice of audience, if we don't have principles to guide that, we're in trouble. And so this is part of it, I'm saying. I would say that we need to pay more attention to what purposes are in our minds, what values we have, and why we do it. I don't think that's a vague matter. I don't think it's a sentimental matter, and I don't think it's an idealistic matter. I think it's a very practical matter. Why do we do the things we do?
Thanks again to our guest, Richard Buchanan. So, John, how did our interview with Richard impact your thinking about the work we are doing with Creative Next?
I particularly enjoyed Richard's framing of intelligence augmentation versus artificial intelligence. I mean, part of it's because there's, you know, some clever acronyms, IA versus AI, et cetera. But beyond that, I liked his emphasis of the technology as extending humanity's intellectual abilities, right? As opposed to replacing, which is sort of the frame that we're usually discussing AI in, is as, you know, replacement technology for, you know, chatbots instead of phone operators, or, you know, some other type of automation instead of, oh, I don't know, graphic designers or robots replacing people on the factory floor. These are all the metaphors and the real examples of the way our perspective is being shaped. So what's powerful about Richard's frame here is that he's seeing the technology as something that we're leveraging as opposed to something that could be used to oppress us, right? And by oppress, I mean in the most general sense, like it's removing opportunities as opposed to creating them, right? So, you know, I thought that was a really good way of sort of proposing the you know, furthering our discussion. And in fact, when we use the term automation in our discussions now, I think I'm going to be a little more sensitive to that because I think we're sort of the same mind as Richard, or at least in the same tribe, right? As far as augmentation, as, you know, humanity doing more interesting things with work, or exploring greater, you know, expanding our boundaries, as opposed to being hemmed in and turned into pod people, right? So
pod people would not be good.
No, but that's what it feels like sometimes when, you know, what's man's place in the, you know, the workforce anymore? It's all going to be machines, and even the creatives aren't safe anymore. So there's an awful lot of overcast skies, right, when we're talking about this. So I found that framing both hopeful and more specifically, I think it also follows this idea that there's a natural progression of our technologies, which are all really for augmentation, right? So if you look at the natural progression of, say, something like, you know, Google is this giant repo of, you know, humanity's information, or at least some of humanity's information.
Or at least the access point to that information.
Right. Yeah. So we're able to extend and augment our thinking because we can have very quick access to facts now, right? So we don't really talk about Google automating fact-finding or, you know, taking away something. I mean, we think of it as a helpful service that enables us to do research more quickly. So I think slotting AI in that same natural progression of augmenting technologies is, at this point, correct, and also maybe a slightly more hopeful way of looking at it.
Yeah, well put, and I agree. You know, the thing that stood out for me was, as we start season three, starting off just with a reminder of how things won't be automated anytime soon, that it is more about that augmentation. And, you know, of course, very few of us are designing at the level of a tax system or policy, or even an organization level. I mean, most people who are designing, again, at sort of the communication and artifact level. But, you know, the bigger problems are well beyond current technology, and even medium-term technology is just not going to be solving for tax systems, let's say. And much of what we feature on the show are the things that will be significantly impacted. But so much more won't. So for me, just reframing again, as we start this next chapter, things are going to go slowly. It is augmentation as a subset of automation, not full automation, is what is going to be driving the things we learn about this season. So, John, what did Richard say that was the biggest surprise or new kernel of knowledge for you?
So Richard talked a bit about his model of types of creativity. And for me, you know, I think about creativity a lot, but I think of it the way a craftsperson would, or, you know, from the perspective of someone who's creating things and executing, right? So I'm always thinking about process. So I'm thinking about, you know, things like research, ideation, drafting, revision. I'm thinking about it in process terms, which I think would be a fairly normal way to view it if you're always trying to produce things, which I usually am.
Yeah.
Now, Richard is obviously thinking about this in a different way. He's talking about types of creativity, which, you know, would intersect with this process model in a couple different ways. So he talks about, let me see if I can remember here, invention, discovery, innovation, and intuition.
That's right.
So you're using these at different points in your creative process, and you may or may not achieve, you know, some of these. I mean, something truly innovative, who knows? You know, that's a pinnacle, right? If you can come up with a solution like that. I thought that framing was very good for helping to articulate what creative work is. So we're often tied to the process, or at least because that's how we learn how to do creative work, is via a process. But it's not the best way to articulate it, especially to folks who are not doing that kind of work. So if you're a business person, or maybe if you're an engineer, or somebody outside of, you know, whatever this creative process is, and you're receiving the benefits of it, but you're not necessarily seeing all the intricacies of it. So I thought that you know, invention, discovery, innovation, and intuition were really good ways to frame up creativity, you know, for a broader discussion.
Yeah.
And I think you made this point earlier that creatives generally and designers specifically are terrible at describing why they did something, you know, sort of instantaneously. Like, we're not natural born. We don't naturally argue in favor of a particular design perspective based on a, you know, like a series of legal arguments or a checklist or anything. It's just, oh, I created this, and why did I do that? And, you know, it's this sort of, and so there have been books, you know, sort of dedicated to helping designers better articulate why they do something.
Yeah, important skill.
So I thought that Richard's model was interesting and very helpful as we're, you know, embarking on, you know, Creative Next and writing about creativity. I mean, it's equally difficult to try to explain the kind of creative work that we think is going to be augmented,
yeah.
Right? So I found that helpful.
I did too. I think both of the frameworks for me were the things that I took away, a sort of new knowledge. The four parts of creativity, which you talked about just now, and also the four orders of design, the progression, communication, artifacts, interactions, and experiences. I think for both of those frameworks, just the way that he's thought through, packaged, made it very accessible, is terrific. And I think is something that both in and of themselves are useful, but also has me thinking about frameworks. And we've been talking about frameworks in this project recently, and it's just another sort of reminder and model for how we can do that too. So what did you learn from Richard that has influenced your life and how you're living today?
At the beginning of the interview, Richard talked a little bit about sort of core skills or abilities of the designer, and he included two main parts in there. He talked about sketching as a way of conveying complex ideas, not necessarily representational sketching, but sketching as a way of visualizing an idea and conveying that to your audience or to your creative team or what have you. Yeah. And then you talked about prototyping, you know, bringing that service or software or artifact to life, you know, in order to, you know, to test it or to see how it might act in the real world. And that abstraction for me, I think, was helpful because, especially as I, you know, writing, music composition, you know, occasional sketching, these sorts of things, it's very difficult. I think it's easy to make things complicated. It's difficult to make things simple and elegant. And the sign of somebody who really knows their stuff is that they can boil down things to their essence. Yeah. So what inspired me from Richard's model there was that he articulated the essentials in such a way that they seemed fresh and new to me. So I'm trying to take that perspective to my different creative endeavors and see how it applies. That's a long way around to saying that, but
nice.
Maybe required, maybe not.
Nice. Yeah, you know, for me, at least some of my activities have been at the fourth order of his framework for many years, but most of them not. And the realities of the world are that most opportunities for all of us for actual paid work are happening at the lower levels instead. And so, you know, as a result, I think that I spend way too much time on things that are parochial, that aren't meaningful in a certain way. They need to be done. They'll be paid for to be done, but do they matter? Maybe not. You know, this is fresh inspiration for me to be thinking about the fourth level and looking for those bigger opportunities and make decisions in my life that have me hopefully making more meaningful things in the future. So each episode we finish up with a thing to think about, one question germane to what's been covered on the show today. This episode's thing to think about is, what do you think of Richard's framework for creativity? Invention, discovery, innovation, and intuition. Think about that for yourself and feel free to tweet at us about it at GoCreativeNext. Creative Next is a proud member of Civil, a community-owned platform for independent journalism. Learn more at civil.co, that's civil.co. We are sponsored by GoInvo, a design practice dedicated to innovation in healthcare, whose clients are as varied as AstraZeneca, 3M Health Information Services, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Learn more at goinvo.com. We're also sponsored by Design Museum Foundation. A new kind of museum, they believe design can change the world. They're online, nomadic, and focused on making design accessible to everyone. Their mission? Bring the transformative power of design everywhere. You can learn about their exhibitions, events, magazine, and more at designmuseumfoundation.org. Our final sponsor is BIF. As a purpose-driven firm, BIF is committed to bringing design strategy where it is needed most: healthcare, education, and public service, to create value for our most vulnerable populations. To learn more and connect, visit them at biff.is. That's biff.is. Please subscribe to Creative Next on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us at Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can get in touch with us at the Creative Next website, creativenext.org, or follow us on Twitter at GoCreativeNext. On Medium, we are partnered with Towards Data Science, where we publish articles to extend and build upon these episodes. Check all that Towards Data Science has to offer at towardsdatascience.com. I'm Dirk Niemeyer, whom you can reach at D. Niemeyer, and my partner in crime is Jonathan Follett, who is at John Follett. Thanks to our guest Richard Buchanan, whose work can be accessed from his faculty page at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. Get started at weatherhead.case.edu. Tweet to us with questions, comments, topics, guest suggestions, and include the hashtag CreativeNext. And the home base for everything we do is at creativenext.org. We recommend you sign up for our low-volume newsletter there. That's it for Creative Next Season 3, Episode 1. But here's a clip of what you can expect to hear next time. We'll see you then.
It will be as common to sprinkle a little machine learning, a little intelligence into an interface, as it is to sprinkle a little JavaScript, a little interaction into a web page.